The contemporary philosopher, Charles Taylor, likes to refer to the historical changes from the Middle Ages to the modern age as the disappearance of the enchanted cosmos, a movement from a world full of external meaning and external significance to one in which whatever deep meaning there is now seems to be located within me. Taylor has a haunting term for this historical process, excarnation. The presence of something beyond what we call today the natural is more palpable and immediate, one might say. Physical in an enchanted age, says Taylor. The sacred, in the strong sense, which marks out certain people, times, place, and actions, is by its very nature localizable, and its place is clearly marked out in ritual and sacred geography. This is what we sense and often regret the passing of when we contemplate the medieval cathedral. God-forsakenness is an experience of those whose ancestral culture has been transformed and repressed by a relentless process of disenchantment, whose deprivations can still be keenly felt. End quote. The result, according to Taylor, is that the sacred is felt to have withdrawn from the physical, visible world. If you want to be deep, you concentrate on your own interior experience. As we've seen from the previous lecture, Lewis, as well as everyone else in his circle, was keenly aware of this historical change, but he also worried about the ethical consequences of the process of this historical excarnation. And it is this idea which occupies him in his Abolition of Man. At the beginning of Abolition of Man, Lewis refers to a passage from an elementary school textbook, which recounts a story recorded about the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. The English poet had visited a waterfall and overhead heard two tourists, one called the waterfall sublime, the other pretty. And Coleridge approved of the first. But the authors of the textbook, who relate this story, provided this interpretation for their students. Quote, "When the man said, 'This is sublime,' he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was, 'I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime,' or, shortly, 'I have sublime feelings.' This confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually, we're only saying something about our own feelings." End quote. Lewis's analysis of this passage is fascinating. He argues that the schoolboy is, in effect, taught that the waterfall is sublime is essentially a worthless claim, because "I have sublime feelings about the waterfall" is merely a subjective assertion. Thus, the schoolboy is silently led to believe two propositions. Quote, "That all sentences containing a predicate of value are statements about the emotional state of the speaker. And secondly, that all such statements are unimportant." When depth migrates from the cosmos to the interior, education turns from, quote, "inculcating just sentiment" to debunking myths and sifting through facts. And Lewis's opinion on this was not ambiguous. Quote, "In a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings to be fruitful." End quote. I remember the first time I read the passage about the waterfall at the beginning of the Abolition of Man. I was at a loss as to think what the alternative would be. What would it mean to have sublimity dwell within the waterfall, as opposed to sublimity being merely my subjective feeling about a waterfall? But in an unexpected passage in his imaginative work, The Great Divorce, Lewis attempts to provide us with such a pre-modern view of what it would be like if dwelling within the waterfall there were an intelligence, a power of intentionality, a deep meaning apart from my own subjectivity, present outside of me, whether I am aware of it or not. In The Great Divorce, Lewis devotes a passage to describing a pathetically stingy man who thinks he is unseen. The greedy man surreptitiously sneaks about the fields of heaven with an aim of gathering up golden apples, which he plans to steal from heaven and sell in hell. The man thinks he's too crafty to be seen. But then his foolish self-delusion is disturbed when he hears a thunderous voice, "Fool, put it down." Lewis continues, "It was quite unlike any other voice I had heard so far. It was a thunderous yet liquid voice. With an appalling certainty, I knew that the waterfall itself was speaking. And I saw now, though it did not cease to look like a waterfall, that it was also a bright angel who stood like one crucified against the rocks and poured himself perpetually down toward the forest with loud joy." End quote. In light of Lewis's comments on abolition of man, we can see the meaning of his imaginative experiment. What if meaning could dwell outside of human minds? What if, built into the created order, there was something more than facts and mechanical operations? That would be a world which demanded an ethical response from us. As we've said, this historical shift, this process which Taylor called excarnation, had significant ethical consequences. If meaning and depth are built-in features in the world, then my goal as a person, as seeking moral development, is to conform myself to that world. Or even better, to let myself be pulled up by those forces of moral gravity, to let myself be lifted up to their lofty level. In contrast to modernity, the Middle Ages thought that our own psychic powers, drives, hopes, ambitions could be brought into conformity with the cosmic order. As Lewis pointed out in his discarded image, just as, quote, "stellar powers command, the angelic beings execute and the terrestrials obey," so too is it that the rational part lives in the body's citadel, the capitolium, that is the head, the camp or barracks, the castra or the chest, warrior-like, the energy which resembles anger, that which makes a man high-spirited, has its station, and then appetite, which corresponds to the common people, is located in the abdomen below them both. End quote. Lewis comments on the wisdom of such a triadic understanding of man's psychological life. He says, "Reason and appetite must not be left facing one another across a no man's land. A trained sentiment of honor and chivalry must provide the mean that unites them and integrates the civilized man." End quote. Indeed, Lewis loved chivalry for this very reason, because he thought it successfully brought together two parts of human beings that do not naturally accompany one another: extreme courage and gentle civility. In his little essay, "The Necessity of Chivalry," he writes, "The important thing about the chivalric is the double demand it makes on human nature. The knight is a man of blood and iron, a man familiar with the sight of smashed faces and the ragged stumps of lopped-off limbs. He's also a demure, almost maiden-like guest in hall, a gentle, modest, unobtrusive man. He's not a compromise or a happy mean between ferocity and meekness. He is fierce to the nth degree, and he is meek to the nth. Medieval chivalry taught humility and forbearance to the great warrior, because everyone knew by experience how much he usually needed that lesson. It demanded valor of the urbane and modest, because everyone knew that he was as likely as not to be a milksop." End quote. But in the modern world, when the cosmos has been, so to speak, morally gutted, in place of such trainings of sentiment, as Lewis put it in Abolition of Man, the modern educator teaches critical thinking skills. Thus, the spirited, that third part of the triad, has gone missing. And Lewis thought that this was profoundly dangerous. Quote, "In battle, it is not syllogisms that will keep the reluctant nerves and muscles to their post. We are told it all long ago by Plato. As the king governs his executives, so reason and man must rule the mere appetites by means of the spirited element. The head rules the belly through the chest, the seat, as Alanus tells us, of magnanimity, of emotions organized by trained habit into stable sentiments. The chest, magnanimity, these are indispensable liaison officers between cerebral man and visceral man. It may even be said that it is by the middle element that man is man." End quote. Given his understanding of the world, it's not surprising that the modern educator does not only not engage in training the sentiments, but thinks it's pedagogically dishonest to do anything but teach how to debunk facts. Lewis cites another example, in which the authors of the elementary textbook analyze a pathetic advertisement for a cruise ship. In order to liberate their pupils from the incantation of advertisement and other forms of mass propaganda, the educators of the textbook point out how factually inaccurate the promises of the advertisement are. Lewis has no problem with them exposing these sentimental claims as shallow. But Lewis also thinks that these modern schoolmasters miss a great opportunity. If these educators, quote, were to stick to their last and teach their readers, as they promised to do, the art of English composition, it was their business to put this advertisement side by side with passages from great writers, in which the very same emotion is well expressed, and then show where the difference lies. They might have used Johnson's famous passage from the Western Islands, which concludes, "That man is little to be envied whose patriotism would not gain force upon the plain of Marathon, or whose piety would not grow warmer among the ruins of Iona." They might have taken that place in the prelude where Wordsworth describes how the antiquity of London first descended on his mind with weight and power, power growing under weight. The right defense against false sentiments is to inculcate just sentiments. By starving the sensibility of our pupils, we only make them easier prey to the propagandist when he does come. Without the aid of trained emotions, the intellect is powerless against the animal organism. End quote. You'll notice that in this passage, Lewis mentions two authors who could provide an antidote to the modern world: Johnson and Wordsworth. Two authors Lewis mentioned, you'll remember, were essential for shaping his sense of vocation and philosophy of life. Two old authors who preserved an even older way of viewing the world, and thus have become precious and even urgent on account of their rarity. Thus, for the reasons described above, Lewis thought the modern man was at a great moral disadvantage, and he used the metaphor of a bad spell, arguing that modernity has cast a peculiar evil enchantment that makes the weight of goodness feel less substantial. For instance, in his famous sermon, The Weight of Glory, Lewis talks about how those raised within the intellectual confines of the modern world, even when they do encounter some strange sensation that there is more than the natural world, have a hard time taking that quiet, whispering voice seriously. He says, quote, "And speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find in ourselves even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you, the secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence, the secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when, in very intimate conversation, the mention of it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves, the secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust them. They are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. Do you think I'm trying to weave a spell? Perhaps I am. But remember your fairy tales. Spells are used for breaking enchantments as well as for inducing them. And you and I have need of the strongest spell that can be found to wake us from the evil enchantment of worldliness, which has been laid upon us for nearly 100 years. End quote. These words about evil enchantment were published in 1941. 3 years later, in Abolition of Man, Lewis returned to the same metaphor of enchantment and suppression when he said, quote, "Almost our whole education has been directed to silencing this shy, persistent, inner voice. Almost all our modern philosophies have been devised to convince us that the good of man is to be found on this earth." End quote. And Lewis returned to the theme of spells and forgetfulness again in a decade later, in 1953, in his children's story, Silver Chair. In that book, three travelers from Narnia, Jill, Eustace, and Puddleclum, have traveled deep underground into the dark kingdom of a witch, who holds a Narnian prince captive by an evil spell. The children wake the prince from his enchantment, but when the witch discovers that her spell has been broken, she has one last opportunity to try to enslave them all by casting yet a new spell of forgetfulness. You'll hear the same echo of enchantment in the following passage. Quote, "The witch said nothing at all, but moved gently across the room. She took out a musical instrument, rather like a mandolin. She began to play it with her fingers, a steady, monotonous thrumming, so that you didn't notice after a few minutes. But the less you noticed it, the more it got into your brain and your blood. This also made it hard to think. After she had thrummed for a time, she began speaking in a sweet, quiet voice. 'Narnia,' she said. 'Narnia, I have often heard your lordship utter that name in your ravings. Dear prince, you who are very sick, there's no land called Narnia.' 'Yes, there is, ma'am, though,' said Puddleglum. 'You see, I happen to have lived there all my life.' 'Indeed,' said the witch. 'Tell me, where that country is?' 'Up there,' said Puddleglum stoutly, pointing overhead. I don't know exactly where.' 'How?' said the queen with a kind of soft, musical laugh. 'Is there a country up among the stones and mortar of the roof?' 'No,' said Puddleglum, struggling a little to get his breath. 'It's an overworld.' 'And what or where, pray, is this, how do you call it, overworld?' 'Oh, don't be silly,' said Scrub, who was fighting hard against the enchantment. 'It's up above, up where you can see the sky and the sun and the stars.' 'Please it, your grace,' said the prince. 'You see, that lamp, it's round and yellow and gives light to the whole room, and hangeth moreover from the roof. Now that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter.' 'Hangest from what, my lord?' 'You see, when you try to think out clearly what this sun must be, you cannot tell me. You can only tell me it is like the lamp. Your sun is a dream, and there's nothing in that dream that was not copied from the lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story." End quote. As you can intuit from this passage, although Lewis wrote this book for children, it's not strictly children's subject matter. Indeed, Lewis, like his friend Tolkien, thought that fairy tales had only become the property of children because modern adults had become incapable of appreciating them. Fairy tales were like, as Tolkien put it, an old couch that's relegated to the nursery, not because it's inherently suitable to children, but because the adults no longer have any use for it. Similarly, as Lewis put it once, sometimes fairy stories may say best what's to be said. Thus, it should not surprise us here that Lewis, through the medium of fantasy literature, describes our modern enchantment as the persistent attempt to suffocate the supernatural sentiments within. I'd like to mention one last place where Lewis returned to this idea of enchantment, in his sermon published in 1962. There, the Oxford Don takes up the modern contention that those deep desires of the heart, those strange feelings of longing for a far-off land, is a simple case of us projecting our desires and hopes and ambitions onto some imaginary higher dimension of reality. And the proof of the ultimately terrestrial nature of these dreams and hopes is how much they overlap with our own lower desires. Lewis uses a metaphor to think through this modern problem, an attempt to show that just because there's overlap of the two realms doesn't mean that our higher sentiments can be reduced to the lower desires. When a symphony, for example, is transliterated as a piano piece, sometimes one piano key will represent a violin, and sometimes that same key will stand for the note of a flute. Quote, "If the richer system is to be represented by the poorer at all, this can only be by giving each element in the poorer system more than one meaning," end quote. Lewis then provides us with a delightful thought experiment. Quote, "If we can imagine a creature who perceived only two dimensions and yet could somehow be aware of the lines as he crawled over them on the paper, we shall easily see how impossible it would be for him to understand. At first, he might be prepared to accept on authority our assurance that there was a world in three dimensions. But when we pointed to the lines on the paper and tried to explain, say, this is a road, would he not reply that the shape which we were asking him to accept as a revelation of our mysterious other world was the very same shape which, on our own showing, elsewhere meant nothing but a triangle? And soon, I think, he would say, you keep on telling me of this other world and its unimaginable shapes, which you call solid, but isn't it very suspicious that all the shapes which you offer me as images or reflections of the solid ones turn out on inspection to be simply the old two-dimensional shapes of my own world, as I have always known it? Is it not obvious that your vaunted other world, so far from being the archetype, is a dream which borrows all its elements from this one? End quote. Thus, the two-dimensional creature doubts the extra dimensions he can't perceive. The witch tries to make the Narnians doubt that there is even an overworld. And modernity similarly casts a spell which makes those longings for a far-off country seem like mere emotions without a proper reference. But note that above, in the passage quoted from The Weight of Glory, Lewis referred to spells used to break enchantments as well as for inducing them. Counterspells, in other words. Thus, in a peculiarly dead and desireless world, in which strong interior impulses seem increasingly out of place, Lewis spent his youth in a kind of confused struggle. On the one hand, he had been trained to adopt a shrewd logical positivism, according to which religion and the traditional sentiments seemed mere fancy. On the other hand, Lewis kept experiencing, especially through the reading of literature, inexplicable moments of uplift and joyful heart. Thus, there existed a kind of war within Lewis's early life between those haunting experiences of what he later called joy and the modern world's attempt to smother that voice within. Although he had committed himself to atheism by the age of 13, he was, we could say, continually haunted by experiences of aching and longing. In Surprised by Joy, his intellectual autobiography of 1955, he looked back on his youth and several of these peculiar moments of aching and described them in rich, vivid detail as a sort of strange, sort of icy but inspiring feeling you get when you think about Iceland. One day, Lewis was reading a volume of Norse myths, illustrated by Arthur Rackham, and he had this experience, quote, pure northernness engulfed me, a vision of huge, clear spaces hanging above the Atlantic in the endless twilight of northern summer, remoteness, severity. And almost at the same moment, I knew that I had met this before, long, long ago. And with that plunge back into my own past, there arose at once, almost like heartbreak, the memory of joy itself. The knowledge that I had once had what I had now lacked for years, that I was returning at last from exile in desert lands to my own country, and the distance of the twilight of the gods and the distance of my own past joy, both unattainable, flowed together into a single, unendurable sense of desire and loss, which suddenly became one with the loss of the whole experience, which as I now stared around that dusty schoolroom like a man recovering from unconsciousness, had already vanished, had eluded me. And at once, I knew, with fatal knowledge, that to have it again was the supreme and only important object of desire, end quote. I think it's right to hear echoes of Plato in such descriptions. You'll remember, perhaps, that in the Phaedrus, Plato uses an elaborate myth to describe the shockingly painful beginning of philosophy. Before our souls were born into this world and assumed the body that they now wear, they served in the retinue of gods. Once a year, our souls would partake in a great jubilant procession around the cosmos. The goal of this procession was to travel to a mysterious land beyond the heavens where something so beautiful dwells that it cannot be described in positive language. Plato says, quote, the place beyond heaven, none of our earthly poets has ever sung or ever will sing its praises enough. What is in this place is without color and without shape and without solidity, a being that really is what it is, the subject of all true knowledge, end quote. But Plato says, in the joyful bustle of the procession, it sometimes happened that you lose control of your horses and your vision is distracted from the ineffably beautiful thing. Because you're worried about crashing into your neighbor, you might only catch a glimpse of it out of the corner of your eye. When the soul fails to draw in through the eyes the nourishing vision of the ineffably beautiful, it doesn't have the strength to continue the journey. The wings of the soul wither and fall out, and the soul falls from heaven into this world and becomes embodied, largely forgetting what its earlier life was like. Just traces of the memory remain, like those of a child whose parents have died when he's very young. And so Plato concludes, when we see something beautiful in this world, it causes us to recollect vaguely in a kind of metaphysical déjà vu moment what we had once longingly gazed upon. The beautiful object triggers a greater response than it seems capable of satisfying, and the soul becomes dazed and confused. Quote, only a few remain whose memory is good enough, and they are startled when they see an image of what they saw up there. Then they are beside themselves, and their experience is beyond comprehension because they cannot fully grasp what it is they are seeing. End quote. Lewis loved this passage from the Phaedrus. He cites the Phaedrus in a letter to his father, written when he was just 17. In 1915, he said, as Plato says, the written world is only a poor, faint shadow of a real conversation. End quote. In that year, Lewis was studying with a private tutor, Mr. Kirkpatrick, to prepare for an entrance exam into Oxford, and he spent most of his days reading Latin and Greek text. He described his daily routine in a letter to a friend, quote, after breakfast and a short walk, we start on Thucydides, a desperately dull and tedious Greek historian, and on to Homer, whom I worship. At 5, we do Plato. 6 years later at Oxford, 1921, Lewis says that after tea, he liked to relax in the garden of his college, reading, quote, a little of the good Plato, end quote. And years later, in a letter to his friend Arthur Greaves in 1930, he wrote, quote, my memories of the Phaedrus are vague, mainly of the beautiful scene in which the discussion takes place, and of the procession of the gods round the sky, end quote. And don't forget how Professor Kirk summarizes the events of Narnia at the end of that series, quote, it's all in Plato, bless me, what do they teach them at these schools, end quote. This war of the mind was the central conflict of Lewis's youth, and it's directly related to his conversion to Christianity. In the mid-1920s, all the conflict came to a head, and like two armies from World War I facing one another down across a no-man's land. On the one side, all of his orthodox, modern beliefs were arrayed. And on the other, there were all the authors he had loved and whom he had found glimpses of joy. There was Spencer and Morris and Yeats, and there was George MacDonald. Quote, I did not yet know the name of the new quality I found so attractive in MacDonald. I do now. It was holiness. For the first time, the song of the sirens sounded like the voice of my mother or nurse. Here were old wives' tales. There was nothing to be proud of enjoying them. It was as though the voice which had called from the world's end were now speaking at my side. End quote. But MacDonald, Lewis reports, seemed to have had the same richness in music that Chesterton did, and also Johnson. Lewis said that he loved them despite their Christianity. But then, quote, Spencer and Milton, and by a strange coincidence, they all had it too. Even among ancient authors, the same paradox was to be found. The most religious, Plato, Aeschylus, Virgil, were clearly those on whom I could really feed, end quote. On the other hand, other authors whom Lewis found merely entertaining lacked religion. And then it got worse. Lewis fell in love with John Donne, with William Langland, and George Herbert, in addition to his old loves for Plato, Dante, Hooker, and Pascal. Lewis sums up the great alignment in this way. Quote, the two hemispheres of my mind were in the sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many-islanded sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. And nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. End quote. In his chapter, Checkmate, from Surprised by Joy, Lewis writes about the feeling of being sieged or surrounded, and about the pressure these sentiments of longing had begun to exert on him. Everyone was ganging up on him, beloved authors and beloved friends. He felt like a fox being chased. Quote, "Nearly everyone was now, one way or another, in the pack. Plato, Dante, MacDonald, Herbert, Barfield, Tolkien, Dyson, joy itself. Everyone and everything had joined the other side, even my own pupil, Griffiths, thought, not yet a believer, though not yet a believer himself, did his share," end quote. But there was still one more step to Christianity. And at a dinner party, during which Lewis hosted two Christians, Hugo Dyson and J.R.R. Tolkien, helped. The three men went for a walk through the grounds of Lewis's college, Magdalen, in Oxford, and discussed mythology, metaphor, and Christianity. Lewis was still having difficulty believing that the Christian mythology was more than just a moving story. For after all, although mythological tales are beautiful and moving, but in the end they are, in Lewis's words, lies, and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver. End quote. But Tolkien fiercely disagreed. Here, in the words of the biographer Humphrey Carpenter, is the dramatic way in which this conversation played out. "No," said Tolkien, "they are not lies." Just then, Lewis recollected later, there was a rush of wind which came so suddenly on the still warm evening and sent so many leaves pattering down that we thought it was raining. We held our breath. When Tolkien resumed, he took his arguments from the very thing that they were watching. "You look at trees," he said, "and call them trees. And probably you do not think about the word. You call a star a star and think nothing more of it. But you must remember that these words, tree and star, were in their original forms names given to these objects by people with very different views than yours. To you, a tree is simply a vegetable organism. A star is simply a ball of inanimate matter moving along a mathematical course. But the first men to talk of trees and stars saw things very differently. To them, the world was alive with mythological beings. They saw these stars as living silver, bursting into flame in answer to the eternal music. They saw the sky as a jeweled tent, and the earth as the womb whence all living things have come. To them, the whole creation was myth woven and elf-patterned." End quote. In other words, myths were not untrue for Tolkien. They were ancient and deep intuitions into reality which had much truth in them. Indeed, God, Tolkien continues, quote, "expressing himself through the minds of poets and using images in their mythopoeia to express fragments of his eternal truth," end quote. Christianity, then, is a myth. But now, quote, "the old myth has become a fact," end quote. Throughout these years, Lewis began to feel like he was trying to block out something, that he had the power to open a door and let it all come in. And what was worse is that this abstract spirit to which Lewis acknowledged with a vague principle of allegiance began to feel to him personal, the traditional god of religion. Lewis began to feel that this person, not just a life principle, was demanding that he open the door. But God would not argue about it. He only said, "I am the Lord, I am that I am, I am," end quote. Lewis began to feel almost afraid, but at the same time, a desire to open the door came upon him. Quote, "I became aware that I was holding something at bay or shutting something out. I felt myself being there and then given a free choice. I could open the door or keep it shut. Neither choice was presented as a duty. No threat or promise was attached to either. Though I knew that to open the door meant the incalculable, the choice appeared to be momentous, but it was also strangely unemotional. I chose to open." Shortly after this, he finally gave in his own words, quote, "in the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England," end quote.